Hello there and welcome to Risky Business episode number 248. My name is Patrick Gray. Now, I've been pretty busy this week preparing my debate speech for tomorrow's Splendour in the Grass Music Festival up in Byron Bay. So this week's show is a bit shorter than usual. There is no feature interview. But in its place, we've got a fascinating sponsor interview with SensePost's Glenn Wilkinson. That's coming up soon. He's a lead security analyst with SensePost in its London office. And he and his colleague Daniel Cuthbert are doing a talk and a tool release at 44Con in September. They set about writing some really creepy Big Brother-style tools for doing massive surveillance by dropping a few wireless access points around London. And you know what? It turns out it's pretty easy to be really creepy. We'll get into that soon, but before we do, it's time for a chat about this week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, we begin this week's news with a pretty massive story for anyone working in the intelligence community. It turns out that there's this naval intelligence bloke in Canada has been putting together some pretty decent tarballs for our friends in Russia.
Yeah, this guy, Jeffrey Delisle, who was apparently arrested sometime in, I believe, January of this year in Canada, worked in some analysis department in Canadian SIGINT in Halifax. And he is accused of, pretty much, going all Bradley Manning up in there, except in a much more sensitive and much more, classified area of the network. And then this leak of data to Russia, which apparently has been going on for years, according to the allegations, has been, I guess, extended into the other five. Country, and it's broken now in the Australian and New Zealand mainstream press.
So I mean, this guy, it has been news over in Canada for a while, but I think the true scope of what this guy is alleged to have done is just becoming apparent. And, you know, they are saying that his disclosure is on par with the sort of scale of Bradley Manning's, but we're talking about stuff of, you know, higher classification. So we're talking about like raw SIGINT from Australian collection as well as, you know, Five Eyes. You've got Canada, US, New Zealand, Australia and England. And it turns out this guy gave them the kitchen sink. I mean, it's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, it sounds like, he's been going around and collecting all the data that he can and feeding it off to the Russians. And the, the idea that it's on the scale of WikiLeaks is, I imagine, got to be pretty scary. And, such detailed information. I mean, having actual raw SIGINT being leaked to Russia is, I mean, not just the contents of the SIGINT, but also, the leaks in terms of what your capabilities are and how you're processing and how you're analyzing, what your pipeline, your analysis pipeline looks like, right? Those are really critical things that you just can't get back.
Yeah, now I'm just reminded of when the whole WikiLeaks thing broke and a lot of people in the United States, a lot of commentators were saying, oh my God, now all of our adversaries have this information. I think you and I at the time were saying that there were, undoubtedly people like this Delisle guy out there sort of zipping it all up and giving it to state powers anyway, because there's just such a massive number of insiders with access to this information.
Well, I mean, clearly he wasn't using RAR because, all, exfiltration appliances now pick up RAR balls after the whole RSA thing.
That's pretty funny.
NetWitness is real well tuned for that now, I bet.
Now it's not just the most sensitive secrets of the world's most powerful nations getting pwned on, it is also the Australian ISP AAPT. Apparently a whole bunch of anonymous affiliated hackers, whatever the hell that means, they have pwned on AAPT, stolen 40 gig worth of data, and this to protest the new laws being considered by the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security here in Australia, which would allow intelligence agencies greater access to internet usage information on Australian citizens.
Yeah, it's not immediately clear what they've stolen. I mean, 40 gig of what exactly? Although I did note that earlier on today, IINet, who own AAPT's email and account management systems, were apparently suffering some kind of outage. So I don't know if that's related or not. But yeah, it's not really clear exactly what they've got. They've been asserting that they're going to leak some sample data sometime today, but we haven't seen any of that yet. It's interesting, this breach, I suppose, because Anonymous, as of the last kind of year or so, have really been doing, some things that haven't really been seen as, reasonably well motivated or well organized or, respectful in some cases of the people that whose data they're leaking out. Whereas this particular fragment of Anonymous seems to be doing a bit of a better job in managing, that bit of their public relations.
AAPT did confirm that this has happened as well. So this isn't one of those situations where Anonymous says, we've got all your datas, and then they go, ha, 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 you wrote about that and we don't really. But look, look, you know, as part of the suggested reform to Australian law, one of the things being considered is that ISPs will have to record information about internet usage and hold it essentially in trust for law enforcement and intelligence agencies for a period of 2 years. And I think what these guys are demonstrating is, hey, and you know, there's been some site defacements and stuff as well, and they're just saying, hey, look, ISPs are not going to be able to keep this stuff secure. So this is a really bad idea.
Yeah, exactly. This is one of the arguments we've had about, you know, increased lawful intercept capability and this kind of data retention, is it makes the places where you are collecting and storing this data such a big target. And, you know, the margins of running an ISP are pretty tight. You know, there isn't a lot of budget in there to do, you know, the kind of security, I mean, even to store the data in the first place.
Well, and there's a lot of talk in the committee's discussion paper about modernizing cost sharing frameworks as well, which is code for making the private sector pay for everything.
Yeah. And, you know, it's hard to see, you know, protecting that kind of data to the level that is necessary, really being, you know, within the core business of being an ISP. You know, they're not going to do a great job of it. And this, you know, really does highlight that.
I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? You know, you don't want to condone the theft of 40 gigabytes of private information on, you know, just a random sampling of the public. But I tell you what, this is making a hell of a point.
Yeah, exactly. Like, making ISPs collect a whole bunch more is only going to make this sort of thing worse. It's not going to stop it happening. It's going to happen more, and the impact will be much, much higher.
Yeah, now, in other and on sort of related news, these guys have been going after Queensland government websites, which is kind of funny because they are protesting a federal law, but they have defaced the Sunshine Coast Council as well. That's like a municipality. Saying, you know, down with these laws. And it's like, guys, come on, you know, it's the Sunshine Coast Council. So that got defaced. And then there was a DDoS attack against some state government departments. There was also a hack of some sort of Queensland state, you know, development department or something website. And these guys, they've done a bit of a paste out there saying, oh, look, you know, we found this database called DSD Web, which is like a tracking database, and it's proof that the Defence Signals Directorate is monitoring Australians. But it's like an access database run by the Queensland Department of State Development.
Yeah, I know. I read that. I read that particular announcement, and it says, you know, this is proof that the Australian government are monitoring its citizens. And, like, you know, if you're monitoring your citizens and the result of that is a 200 meg access database, I think you're probably safer than anywhere else in the Western world. Because that's, yeah. Access, 200 meg, not so flash.
Yeah, it's not exactly elite. You know, I think you could put away the tinfoil hat on that one. You know?
Yeah, you don't need a massive data center in Utah to store your, you know, 200 meg database there.
Well, look, let's move on to some more conventional news now. And, you know, there's some interesting news bubbling out of Vegas. And, you know, normally these high-level talks aren't usually worth sort of bringing up in a news segment, but there's a bloke from Dell Secureworks who's done an interesting overview of an analysis of botnets being operated out of China, and he's really done a good job of tying, of demonstrating the nexus between criminal organizations and the Chinese state and, you know, intelligence versus crime and that sort of stuff. It seems like an interesting little talk.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of analysis, as you say, often you know, is quite fluffy. But Joe Stewart is a, you know, fairly solid researcher, and the some of the stuff that he's pulled together out of this, you know, really is quite compelling. And he tracks down you know, like a couple of thousand domain names and, you know, a couple of hundred types of malware and attempts to attribute them to a couple of groups primarily in Shanghai and Beijing. And it, you know, it's an interesting piece of research, and you know, certainly worth your time having a look at.
Yep. Now, I'm publishing links also in show notes these days. So if you head to risky.biz, you will be able to find links to all of the articles that we are discussing on the show. Now, also, Microsoft has announced that it's actually implementing the technology that won its Blue Hat Prize, according to CNET.
Yeah, they've been pushing out updates to their EMET, you know, exploit mitigation toolkit technology, which is, you know, available at the moment. It's sort of an optional add-on thing. And they've implemented some of the anti-ROP techniques that came out of submissions to their Blue Hat competition. They haven't actually announced, it appears, a winner. They're using techniques from one of the submissions. Like, nearly all of the submissions addressed ROP mitigation technologies, and they've picked, you know, kind of one of those and are implementing it. But they haven't actually come out and said the Croatian guy who developed it is actually the winner yet. So,
oh, that's right. They've got to wait around and see who wins the booby prize of the MSDN subscription or whatever.
Yeah. But so hopefully that guy does get his, you know, $200,000 because that would be quite nice, I'm sure, if you're a, you know, a university researcher. He's got a guy from University of Zagreb a PhD in computer science, if you're still at university, I'm sure a 200K would help a lot.
Yeah, and I'd also think, too, that the fact that they're using his tech, you know, would kind of be a hint, you would think.
Well, you'd certainly hope so. You'd be disappointed if not.
Yeah, look, I think the Blue Hat thing, I mean, they've solved a pretty specific problem with it. I think it seems like a good idea, and we'll just have to see if they run it again.
Yeah, I know I'd said some not particularly kind things about it when they announced it, and I'm glad to see that I was wrong and Microsoft was right, and they have got some useful things out of this.
Yeah, indeed. Now, Charlie Miller is over there in Vegas, and you don't want to stand near him. He's done some really cool research where he's basically found bugs in the NFC interface, the card interface on contemporary phones, and he can ponzo your phone just by, walking near you.
Definitely do not stand near Charlie Miller or anyone who knows Charlie Miller, because he apparently applied for some funding under the DARPA Cyber Fast Track program.
Great Big Mudge Slush Fund.
He hit up old buddy Mudge for some fat cash and used that to buy a bunch of Android phones and spend some time doing a research on their NFC implementations. And he's managed to implement a couple of attacks, one which uses NFC to convince your Android phone to, follow a web link and then from there kind of, download and run through existing vulnerabilities, exploits against your Android phone, thus owning you. He's implemented a similar sort of thing where against Nokia's N9 phones, they run like the Mego embedded Linux, where he can essentially force a Bluetooth pairing to occur via NFC, even if you've got Bluetooth pairing turned off on your phone, which is hilariously bad. He seems to be poning all over that NFC stuff, which is good, because I would really like to see this stuff owned now before it's widely deployed. Certainly it's not widely deployed here in New Zealand yet, but it's big in Europe, not so much in the US. But breaking this earlier rather than later seems like a very good plan.
Oh, look, NFC is going to be, we're going to have it everywhere soon, and I think it's going to be the iPhone 5, because the iPhone, whether you're an Apple fanboy or not, you got to admit that the iPhone definitely was a game changer in terms of the way that we're all walking around with these devices now, and they're going to ship NFC. And then you've got your Google Wallet sort of applications, and you're going to see them setting up coupon style businesses so you can buy $30 worth of sushi for $20 from your local sushi store, and it's integrated with their POS systems. And, NFC is going to be a big deal. So you're absolutely right. Better for this stuff to happen now.
Yeah, indeed. I was at the pub the other day and somebody whipped out their Android phone and started scanning people's wallet and pulling out their credit card numbers for a bit of cheap lulls. So, yeah, it's definitely happening.
Cheap lulls, and you get to settle the tab at the end of the night. So that's very good. Now, staying in Vegas, and a bunch of dudes have figured out how to fool iris scanners by creating these contact lenses that can, fool an iris scanner into thinking that it's someone else. It's very James Bond. It's very Mission Impossible.
Yeah, this is some really great research. There's a couple of guys, I think, from university in Spain who've been doing this research. And essentially what they've done is taken hash values of your used in biometric databases that store iris scans and reversed those, kind of cracked them back into images which you can print on a contact lens and use to fool an iris scanner.
Oh, that's cool.
Is awesome work, because the big problem with biometrics is it's a factor that you are, not that you have, right? It's your eyes are you, and if someone steals your password, specifically your iris pattern, then you can't change your password. This is the core of the argument against biometrics, and this kind of research is very, very valuable for demonstrating why this is such a big problem. And to be able to take these essentially like 5,000 bit hash values that describe an iris and generate an actual matching image is not something that anyone else has been able to demonstrate before. And of course all the biometrics companies say, oh no, you can't do this, they're hashed, it's one way cryptographically, blah de blah. And these guys implemented a genetic algorithm that kind of evolves matching patterns of iris and then the tech for printing them and stuff, and it's very, very cool research.
And I'm guessing that it's going to save a few people from having their eyeballs cut out.
Well, that's also a benefit, yes.
Now, Siemens, meanwhile, has patched a SCADA bug in some of its gear. It looked like a pretty serious one.
Yeah, it was. It's like the standard DLL search path sort of thing. Mm. But yeah, it's a way where you can essentially write a file and result in code being loaded. So it's not a particularly good thing. Good look for them. But yeah, at least they've actually now patched it. But yeah, but yeah, you know,
you've got to assume there's a whole bunch of other scary shit in there, though. You know,
well, like, I mean, of course there is, right? Mm. I mean, and the fact that it's taken them this long to, and they're still patching vulnerabilities that, you know, out in the rest of the real world are the sort of thing that should have been taken care of a long time ago is just not, is not.
So, in other words, it's business as usual in Scarterland.
Yeah, well, yeah, sadly, I'm just amazed that the power is even on at all.
That's right. I'm amazed that I turn on the tap and water comes out. Now, last yeah. week we had a bit of a chat about the Grum botnet, which was taken down by, I think, among other people, FireEye. Now, look, you know, it seems the guys who were running this botnet did some, you know, real scrambling behind the scenes and did some pretty epic arm twisting to get a ISP to actually reinstate its CNC for a short time. I mean, it's been yanked again. This resulted in the hosting company that was actually hosting these CNCs. They got threatened with de-peering over this. I mean, this turned into kind of a big deal. But walk us through it, Adam.
Yeah, so you may recall last week we discussed there was a bunch of CNC servers around the world, but there were about maybe three in this one particular ISP in Ukraine who were the last to actually pull the plug on these boxes. And then subsequently, a few days later, they magically got turned back on again. And the allegation, of course, is that there was, you know, either money or arm twisting or, you know, kneecaps were exchanging hands somewhere. and a couple of the CNC boxes came back on online. Now, you would assume that had this been well planned and executed, they would have pushed an update and yeah. set up a whole bunch of new CNC servers and managed to kick the whole botnet back into life. It doesn't look like that's happened. They sent some spam. Presumably there was stuff left in the queue and the job for, you know, change command and control servers didn't actually make it through before the FireEye guys, you know, phoned up and you know, waved their angry stick at the hosting provider and said that they were going to try and get them de-peered from their upstream, which, you know, hopefully was enough of a stick to you know, cause them to now turn them off again. But yeah, it's it seems like the Grum guys flubbed that one, unfortunately for them.
Going back to Vegas now, and there was a funny little thing that happened. Basically, everyone attending got what looked like a phishing email.
yeah, all the Black Hat attendees got a phishing mail, and everyone, of course, assumed that someone had owned Black Hat stuff or, you know, something bad had happened, or that it was a hilarious hoax. And it actually turned out to be someone in the middle, some Black Hat volunteer was poking around with the mailing system used by their, you know, the company they outsource registration to, and sort of accidentally appears to have sent an admin password reset mail to absolutely everybody.
Yes, oops.
Oops. And there's a, you know, a fairly, you know, amusing blog post on blackhat.com kind of saying, yeah, our bad. Nothing really bad happened. Sorry about that. Geez.
Just a bit of a fun start for the event.
Yeah. Well, you kind of expect it, right?
Now, look, there is some more news from Vegas. There's been some more interesting research come out of there. There's a testing framework, a security testing framework for smart meters has been released over there in Vegas. Now, this is interesting.
Yeah, these guys implemented the communication stack used by a bunch of the smart meters in Python, so it makes it easy to kind of glue in for the rest of your tools. They've also implemented you know, the plumbing for actually talking to the smart meters. There's a particular type of like an optocoupling interface that uses infrared LEDs and runs like serial over the top of it, standard kind of RS-232 serial over the top of infrared, you know, free space optical kind of thing. You know, you stick a light on an opto receiver and off it goes. Anyway, they've implemented this testing tool which uses a number of the, you know, fairly standard, easily available interfaces that you can build yourself or buy. And, you know, that provides a leg up through the sort of layer one, layer two for talking to these devices so that everybody else who doesn't necessarily understand that can get on with actually owning them.
Well, I'm sure it'll be very handy stuff for people who work in the sort of smart metering, you know, auditing, rolling out, designing, architecting sort of space, who might need to do some evaluations on this sort of stuff. Now, I want to draw our attention to the funny story of the week, which is a post on ZDNet's Zero Day blog, which is a picture of a HDMI cable's, you know, wrapper, its box, which claims that it is actually that it actually has antivirus protection in it, which is just brilliant.
yeah,
it's right up there with Apple's marketing.
Well, yeah, and those, you know, gold-plated HDMI cables that, you know, reduce analog interference on your digital signal or something silly like that. But yeah, it's pretty amusing antivirus protection on your cables.
Yes, it says 100% Mylar Double Shield 1.3C grade cable with antivirus protection to reduce virus noises and to obtain perfect image transmission.
Yeah, see, I'm hoping that that's just bad Google Translate. they may actually mean that it does stop viruses, and, you know, probably that is as good as, you know, any other antivirus product you're going to buy. So, hey.
Now, Gary McKinnon, my God, this guy is still fighting his extradition. Apparently, he's the NASA alien hacker guy who's in the UK, who's been fighting his extradition for God knows how long now. He is expecting a decision on his extradition in mid-October.
Yeah, apparently he has to wait even longer because everybody in the entire of Britain is currently busy Olympicing or something.
Yeah, that's right. But
You know, in terms of stalling your extradition, it's not a bad way of going about it.
Yeah, well, he got done for this in 2002 and they started extradition proceedings in 2005. So this has been going on basically for my entire career as an InfoSec reporter. Well, nearly, anyway.
Oh, man, poor guy, really.
Yeah,
you just
want
to find some aliens. You
just let it go, man. You know, you were all paranoid. It was just after September 11, but, you know, we can just chill out now. Oh, and finally, Adam, it wouldn't be the news without reporting on zillions and zillions of passwords being owned. 8 million passwords have been stolen from a German gaming website. That's a lot of passwords.
Yeah, 8 million. Apparently they were actually hashed, but people who've stolen them said they've cracked at the moment something like 94%, so I'm going to assume it was straight up MD5 or something like that. And yeah, that's a lot of credentials. Sucks to be Germany.
Yeah, sucks to be anyone running a large website and relying solely on passwords now because, that's been the theme of the year. But that's actually it for this week's news, Adam. Thanks a lot for joining us as always, and we'll chat to you again next week.
And no problem, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
Adam Bailo there with a look at the week's news headlines. This week's show is brought to you by SensePost. SensePost is a security consultancy based in South Africa, but it also has a presence in Europe. Glenn Wilkinson is a lead security analyst with SensePost in London. And in September, he's doing a presentation at 44Con with his colleague Daniel Cuthbert. They'll be talking about some simple techniques to do some real Big Brother-style analysis of the general population through some simple Wi-Fi-based techniques. The presentation is called Terrorism, Tracking, Privacy, and Human Interactions, and it looks to be a cracker. Basically, these guys wanted to build a simple, extensible profiling system and use wireless access points distributed around London or wherever to feed it information. And as it turns out, you can learn a lot about your fellow citizens by doing this, as Glenn explains.
So we've deployed a distributed tracking and profiling framework, and nothing we've actually built is new. So we're stitching together other ideas, putting them together, and hoping to get something out of it that's greater than the sum of the parts. So we've broken down the project into two distinct phases, the tracking of people and profiling of people. And at this stage, the way we're tracking people is by their mobile devices or their laptops. When they're out in the world, their devices are probing for known networks that they've previously connected to. So you're wandering down the street and your iPhone is looking for Risky Biz Wi-Fi and for Sydney Harbour Wi-Fi and for Starbucks. And so shouting out these probe requests, and associated with that is your MAC address. So I can uniquely identify you or your device as you walk down the street. Hey, there's that MAC address. I've seen this device before. So if I have enough of these APs distributed over an area, so if I go to London and I drop 50 access points all over and someone's walking down the street with their iPhone, I can uniquely identify that device. And okay, it got off at Clapham Junction and then I next saw it at Victoria and then I saw it over here. So we can, on quite a large scale, track lots of different people as they move around by looking at probe requests from their mobile devices. And that's not new. People have done it before, but it's putting in a distributed manner and correlating that data at a central database and then getting help from guys like Roloff and his Multigo software to build up nice transformations of, okay, these two people got off the train together over here, then they separated, and then we saw them again at some other location.
Well, this is interesting, this physical tracking stuff, because, you know, I recently found out that the government in the Australian state of Queensland, the roads authority there, actually have these gantries set up which grab Bluetooth MAC addresses of, like, you know, mobile phone kits in cars as they drive past, and then they can actually see how long it is taking for each vehicle to get through a tunnel or get through this particular bit of freeway, and they use that for traffic analysis. I mean, you know, a good question is what happens to that data, whether or not they log it or store it. But this stuff is being logged by governments for various, you know, reasons that seem quite innocent, but still, you know, give me the give me the creeps. But I mean, you're talking about taking it to the level where you can see who's spending time with who, who's popping up in various areas. Did you actually look at collecting more information on data that was running through the device?
Okay, so that's the one stage. So looking at tracking people, and then the other side of the coin is looking at profiling people. So we have these APs set up. The one thing they're doing is looking at unique MAC addresses of devices to track people. But then also the framework allows you to create rogue access points and force devices to, or trick devices into associating to them. And then traffic gets passed through the devices to a central server we have on the internet. So if anyone in any of these 50 locate, say we have 50 APs out there and someone associates to one of them, all that traffic gets routed through a central server I have on the internet. And because all traffic gets passed through a central location, it allows us to manipulate traffic at that central location. So we can deploy SSL strip at that one point on the server, or we can insert arbitrary JavaScript or HTML at one point on that server and affect all clients connected to, say, all those 50 APs out there.
So but this isn't something that you wound up activating, is it? Because there were some legal concerns.
We haven't collected any data with it yet. We're kind of demonstrating that it's possible to intercept data and collect it at that level. But so far, we've only collected data pertaining to individual MAC addresses. So we've been doing data collection on the tracking part, but not on the profiling part. So rather, we're going to demonstrate that the profiling part is possible and release a whole bunch of cool transformations and whatnot with Multigo, help from Ruluf over there.
So basically, you're going to release the tools and hope someone else takes the legal risk.
We'll release the tools and demonstrate that it's possible and see if people, maybe in other countries where such things aren't so illegal, maybe they'll take the project forward and play with it.
Now, what would these tools enable someone to actually do?
So what we've developed on the server side, so that one central server point, all traffic gets passed through. We have a bunch of scripts that pull out things like session cookies. So for Facebook, for example, so pull out session cookies, pull out login credentials for mail, for web, for all sorts of things. And that gets populated into a database on the server. And then we have Multigo transforms, which pull that stuff out and do not complicated profiling, but a level of profiling on people. So say we're in London, we have these 50 APs deployed, and we've got loads of victims connected and their traffic's being routed through. And we're pulling out, say, Facebook session IDs. And through quite an easy automated process, we can then extract, say, everyone's friends.
This was going to be my first question, is whether or not you could actually dump friends lists, and then you can actually start correlating who knows who and which MAC address and physical locations, and then it all starts falling into place, doesn't it?
Yeah, for sure. So you have this large net capturing all this data, and it comes through a central point, and then we can say, okay, through the tracking process, these two people were at this train station together. And according to their Facebook profiles, they're in a relationship together. And then they went to this location where we saw this person join them. And according to Facebook, that's a friend of theirs. And we can build up this kind of distributed profiling of people. So not profiling individuals, but maybe profiling a collection of people in a large area.
But you could also do things with tools like Multigo, is you could say take URLs out of header information and look at what they're reading. You could do a keyword analysis on what these people are reading, and then you can know what this group of people are into. I mean, they might be BMX bicycle enthusiasts, or they might be, a member of a particular political group or something like that. I mean, that's really where you can take this stuff to. Do your tools allow you to do that?
So what we're hoping is it's going to be quite extensible. So we'll release some tools, and we'll release the base framework and some sample Multigo transforms and some sample scripts. And we'll hope that people will take it forward and do things like that, try and work out if there's any political affiliations or perhaps what sexuality people are. And that kind of thing's been done in smaller projects before, but nothing on this kind of scale. And I suspect these kinds of abilities. And sorry, there's something else I didn't mention as well. So on the tracking / profiling side, when people are walking around with their mobile phones in their pockets and their mobile phones are broadcasting for all known networks they previously connected to, so your home network and Starbucks and your work network, we also use that for profiling. So there are services out there that allow you to map a network name to a GPS location. Mm. I'm not sure about in Australia, but especially in the UK, your home Wi-Fi with a BT and Virgin and whatnot, they have very unique network names. So for example, it might be BT Home Hub 26149. And that's a very unique name. And the UK being a small island that it is, it's so dense of access points. And so if one of my monitoring devices sees someone walking along who's connected to BT Home Hub 62149, Virgin Business Hub 1234, et cetera, I can instantly determine, okay, this individual, this device lives at this location and works at this location. And I've actually built a distributed, multi-threaded, probably overcomplicated system that will take these SSIDs and in real time look them up, get the GPS location, pass that onto another system which gets a street address, pass that onto another system and gets a street view address. So in real time, as people are walking around, I can kind of plot them on a map and say, okay, this guy lives here, he works here, he has a photo of his home, he has a photo of his work, and he's with this person and it looks like they're both connected to this home network, so they probably live together. And this third person, they both connect to the same work network, so they probably work together.
Now, look, I got to ask, I mean, it seems like building this framework, you know, this is one guy building it. I mean, there are companies that have entire product lines dedicated to this stuff. Did it surprise you? Was the ease of this surprising to you?
So as I said in the beginning, when we got this idea, it was from looking at, you know, big governments and big private organizations with huge budgets who can do this kind of thing on a grander scale. And myself and Daniel Cuthbert thought, well, can we maybe do that just the two of us with a couple of MacBooks and some spare research time, because neither of us are full-time researchers. This is kind of a side project for us. And as I said earlier, Haroon from Thinkst kind of pointed out that actually, unless you have your own set of clusters, that's probably not going to work. But at the same time, we think that just the two of us with a bit of spare time, we've got quite a decent framework for doing some level of profiling and some level of tracking. I think it's going to be quite a nice project being kind of crowdsourced out. So giving this tool, this kind of framework to lots and lots of people, and the more people that deploy it or get involved in it, the more data we can collect, and maybe the more people that get involved in writing transforms and looking at the data, then, okay, company X in the States, X billion dollars and 20 PhDs, well, we have this nicely crowdsourced thing.
How scary did you find this process? Was it easier or harder than you thought it would be? And what does it make you think about here in Australia, we've got the government trying to introduce new, you know, interception capabilities and make them legal and pass off more information about internet usage to the government, to intelligence agencies. I mean, did you have that moment where you just thought, shit, this is actually quite easy, and it's a little bit frightening the level of insight that can be gleaned from this information? Or was it just, you just sort of found what you'd expect?
So to answer that, from a technical point of view, it was a little bit difficult. So given that only 15% of my time is research time, so it was a little bit difficult from the technical side. But once I got the momentum going and I started seeing results, I actually thought, hey, this is actually pretty scary, considering it's just two of us with a bit of extra time and a couple of MacBooks. We can actually get a base level of quite a decent profile on people. To give a small example, I was sitting in a coffee shop in London with one of the scripts running, and two dudes walk into the coffee shop speaking Arabic to each other, and my software pops up saying, okay, two new devices detected, geolocating, dot, 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 and gives me a nice quick map of a point, street address in a small town in Saudi Arabia. So as this dude walks in, within 5 seconds, I know that at some point in time, this is likely his home in the middle of Saudi Arabia. And we start seeing results like that, you realize, hey, this is actually quite scary. And then if you add on the extra stuff of forcing his device to associate to you and intercepting his Facebook and that kind of stuff, you can build up a pretty decent framework. You can build a pretty decent profile of people. And even if you're only building up a basic profile of people, if it's distributed on a large enough scale that you have thousands or tens of thousands of people being profiled, even at the basic level, it gives you quite a nice big picture of I guess human interactions and what people are doing and political affiliations and this kind of thing.
Hey, where did you get that that GPS to Wi-Fi data? I mean, is that just like something you can get from Google Street View or something? Or how did you actually make that association between that particular SSID and that small town in Saudi Arabia?
So there are various services out there. So there's Wiggle.net, there's Skyhook, Google has some kind of functionality. So basically, there are a handful of web services out there, and basically, so there's two options. There's a commercial option, and there's the free open source type option. All it is, it's basically war driving. So either on the commercial side, so for example, when Google did Street View, as they were doing Street View, they also had a wireless device mapping all network names as they drove along. Okay, here's Glenn's Wi-Fi at this GPS coordinates.
So there's crowdsourced equivalents for that data.
Yeah, so there's also free options out there. So for example, wiggle.net. So that's basically a online war driving type service. So you get an app on your iPhone and you walk around your neighborhood and you detect a bunch of APs and their GPS coordinates and you upload it to their database. And they've got, I think it's in the order of 1.5 million odd APs around the world. But it's a pretty dense list they've got. But what we had to do was try and do a little bit of commercial, a little bit of free. So the problem with the free options is they throttle you. You can only make 20 yeah. requests and that kind of thing. So I developed a whole bunch of solutions to best leverage that to my needs.
You mean to bypass the API rate limits?
Yes.
Hey, Glenn, that's all we're going to have time for this week, mate. But that's some very, very scary stuff. Thank you. I don't think anyone will be sleeping any better after listening to that. Thank you so much for joining us on Risky Business, and I'm sure we'll chat to you again in the future.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
Glenn Wilkinson there with a chat about his extensible distributed profiling system that will be debuting at the 44Con conference in London in September. And that is it for this week's show. This week's track is by the Cactus Channel and it's called Boss Cat. These guys are from Melbourne, but I'm pretty sure they're touring soon, so check them out. Check out a gig guide. Very, very funky stuff. And I hope to bring you some excerpts of the debate that I'm participating in tomorrow in next week's show. Until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.